Thanks for downloading Think from KERA 90.1 Dallas-Fort Worth. You can learn more and support this program at kera.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 240-horsepower turbocharged Acura RDX. More at acura.com/RDX.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Does a free press guarantee that the public has access to the unvarnished truth? Or can government officials still spin important stories more easily than we think? My guest today believes there is something seriously wrong with the news business in America, and he points to the bandwagon coverage of crises like 9/11, the Iraq War, and the Abu Ghraib prison scandal as evidence. Stephen Livingston is associate professor in the School of Media and Public Affairs and the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. Together with Lance Bennett and Regina Lawrence, he is the author of When the Press Fails, Political Power and the News Media from Iraq to Katrina. Steve, welcome to Think.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So interesting. Very often, people within the Bush administration portray themselves as quite beleaguered by the media, as opposed to the other way around. Is that just part of the strategy?
No, I think it really is the case that many people, I mean, if you were to ask Scooter Libby right now if he felt battered by the press, I think he would say quite definitively that he is. So from a certain vantage point, it's true that the press does indeed hold individuals accountable, such as Scooter Libby. But on the whole, what we found in our study, exhaustive, careful content analysis of the kinds of coverage that went into exactly what you were talking about, the lead into the war, you find that there is indeed a bias, but it's a bias towards taking the assumptions offered to it, the press, by the White House at face value. And that's really what we're concerned about.
One thing that you did was look at the kind of spending that was done on public relations coverage. And the GAO found $1.6 billion spent on PR.
Isn't that a remarkable figure? And a lot of that was spent by the Defense Department, but not entirely by the Defense Department. But you have a number of ways in which that takes place. One, video news releases that are produced either for or by various government agencies, including the Department of Education, not just the Defense Department, but then are distributed to affiliates around the country, television news affiliates, and run as if they were segments produced by those news organizations themselves. And this is taxpayer money being used essentially to promote policies, particular policies of a particular administration. And that's the sort of thing that we find disturbing.
And look, every administration has tried to spin the news and make sure that it's portrayed favorably. Let's talk about what makes this coverage different and why the media were so acquiescent to what they were being told.
Well, I think in part we need to begin and recognize that 9/11 changed everything, as we were told and reminded, and it's true. I mean, following 9/11, there was a rally around the flag that's understandable. The Bush administration stepped forward, and its initial response with the war in Afghanistan that was widely supported. I think that even to this day, you'll find very little controversy regarding U.S. actions or administration's actions in Afghanistan. But the decision to invade Iraq changed that calculus. And that's also, though, where the press failed to step forward. It was almost a continuation of the sort of rally effect that we found with Afghanistan that was carried over, at least initially, to Iraq. I mean, some of our listeners may be wondering, well, what are you talking about, Professor? I mean, the administration, and certainly if an administration official were listening to this, they would say, of course, we're being hit hard by the press. But it's important that we keep in mind the time series involved. We're talking about in 2002, late 2002, 2003, in the lead-in to the war in Iraq. That's the period when there should have been more press oversight, and we found systematically that there was not. And that's the concern that we have and what we try to explain in When the Press Fails.
Can you explain what you discovered about why there was no significant media challenge to the non-existent link between 9/11 and Iraq, or Saddam Hussein specifically?
Well, I mean, eventually the New York Times and the Washington Post and the other elite media that we focus on here, I mean, what we are looking at is how the newspapers, the elite newspapers that so often set the agenda of other news organizations around the country, how they either succeed or failed. And as we point out in the book, eventually Bill Keller managing editor of the New York Times, felt compelled to even offer a mea culpa, an apology for the lack of diligent or critical coverage of the assertions made by the administration regarding WMD. A lot of fingers are pointed at a particular reporter, Judith Miller, either fairly or unfairly, but certainly it's the case that Judith Miller, who became well-known in connection with the Scooter Libby trial, but she was the one who had her byline on many of the stories that spoke in not only breathless but definitive terms about the idea that there were WMD, weapons of mass destruction, to be found in Iraq. If I may add one more thing, though, it's just not WMD. There was the constant allegation that there were ties between al-Qaeda, that was responsible for 9/11, and Saddam's regime in Iraq, which was not responsible for 9/11. Those assertions by the administration were also generally accepted without critical comment by the New York Times and the Post and the other media, such as we look at in the book.
One of the most common criticisms lobbed at Judith Miller since all of this has come to light, sort of subsequent to the events, is that she was really just chasing fame. She was trying to advance her career, not necessarily deliberately lying about things, but clearly more than eager to just parrot back what she was told by the administration. Is that a fair accusation?
I think it may be, but one of the things that I'm eager to point out is that this book is not about the failings of any individual reporter. Instead, the failings at this level are systematic. They are a part of the way in which journalism operates in this country, at least the way it's been operating in the post-9/11 era. And so when we look at what an individual reporter does or fails to do, that's important. There are also occasions where individual reporters are doing a fantastic job and really bring to the American public the kind of information that we need to know. There are other occasions where we and probably the reporters themselves wish they had done something differently. So what we're interested in is trying to understand those systematic factors that go into the failure of the press.
Let's talk about that a little bit. Steve, what kind of relationships do these top-level reporters need to have with people in power in order to get the kind of access that is required for really great coverage?
You know, some of this goes back to self-imposed limitations. I mean, one of the things that we find in not only our book, but other books, other scholars and journalists themselves that have looked at these kinds of questions over the years, one of the things that we find is that, at least as it operates here in the city where I am, in Washington, D.C., journalists come to understand that their role is to get the scoop, hear what the latest is from officials, officials in the White House or occasionally on Capitol Hill or in the bureaucracies. And certainly it's important for us to pay attention to what the White House is saying. But the problem becomes when they limit their understanding of what quote-unquote objective reporting involves to just what officials say, without leaving room for alternative sources of information from outside the halls, corridors of power. That's when we end up with a press that often, at its worst, serves as little more than a magnifying glass or a bullhorn for administration points of views, ways of seeing the world, ways of seeing the problems that confront the United States. So it's that self-limiting effect that goes on. And if I might add one more thing, when it's at its worst, it becomes an incestuous relationship, where you see the kinds of things that you saw in the testimony offered in the Scooter Libby trial, where officials in the vice president's office are identifying the reporters they know that they can call to get the word out that the vice president's office wants out to the American public. That's a little too close. We need an independent press.
Do you think that the journalists were lulled into trusting the administration's objectives by previous administrations that might have been more candid or a little, maybe had less to spin?
Well, I think one of the things, not to sound cynical, but rather skeptical, there is a difference. I mean, a skeptic would say with all administrations are interested in spinning. It's just that with this particular administration, at this point in American history, the consequences of spin are greater. I mean, as a result of the spin we have had from the Bush administration, we find ourselves in an intractable war in Iraq, perhaps a failing effort in Afghanistan, where our efforts should have been focused in the first place steadfastly. And so the consequences of the spin have been greater with this administration than when we were being spun about Monica Lewinsky and that sort of thing. So that's, I think, the first thing that we need to keep in mind.
Can you talk a little bit about Ron Suskind and what he was told specifically and quite blatantly by a senior member of the administration?
Yeah, I think you're referring to, I mean, this is just a wonderful quote, and Ron is a great journalist, and we would do well to follow his reporting. But one of the things that that he has published came from a high-level, anonymous high-level Bush administration official. We have a quote that leads off one of our chapters. If I might, I could even just read a bit of it.
That would be great.
Yeah, what he says is, we're an empire, and he's quoting a high-level Bush administration official. Others have said that the official sounds remarkably like Karl Rove, but that's never been substantiated by Ron Suskind. We're an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality. And while you're studying that reality, judiciously as you will, we'll act again, creating another new other new realities, which you can study too, and that's how things will work out. We're history's actors, and you, all of you, will be left to just study what we do. This is an example of the kinds of hubris, the idea that through images and language and spin, you can create, not just change people's perception, but actually almost to an extent of recreating a reality in the image that you wish it to be. That sort of hubris is what informed, we believe, the administration going into Iraq, and of course, I think we're seeing evidence that that hubris was overstated and misplaced.
Has there always been a certain amount of shunning by the White House, by any White House, for reporters who write highly critical stories?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I mean, part of it is it's very systematized. Reporters who are critical of the White House in a sustained fashion aren't the beneficiaries of scoops, leaks. They aren't invited to come up and talk with the president on Air Force One if they are on the White House press corps. You know, so absolutely, there's an effort on the part of all administrations to try to manage the press in that way. But again, we need to go back and look at the high stakes that's involved right now with this particular administration working with the press corps here in Washington, D.C. The stakes are so high, and they were so high in the fall of 2002, 2003, going into the March invasion of Iraq, and that's what we really need to focus on and think about and what we talk about in the book.
Do you think it could be in part that there had not been significant reporting before about the threat of terrorism in this form? And so since journalists didn't necessarily see 9/11 coming, they somehow lost faith in their own power to assess the risks and then turned to this group of people who seemed to be suddenly the experts on this.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are plenty of experts. Part of what we talk about in the book and when the press fails is that some of those experts were silenced. And so we were left with just a handful of people such as Rumsfeld or President Bush or others. And instead, some of the people that you would normally turn to as a reporter in the intelligence community even were fearful of stepping forward and contradicting the administration. So the sphere of available sources was shrunk at this crucial time when we needed more information instead of having more information available to us as the public. Through our journalism, we ended up with a restricted view. I mean, one of the examples that we talk about in the book hasn't to do with Iraq, but it has to do with climate change. There's a NASA scientist named Dr. Hansen who was the subject of in his view, I guess, a bit of a political campaign to silence him because he was stepping forward and saying early on that there was clear evidence that that there was global warming going on and that the United States should be doing something about it. And he had a 24-year-old political appointee oversight person whose job it was is to try to monitor and prevent him from speaking out. So this sort of thing happened all through the administration.
Steve Livingston is my guest. He is a co-author of a new book called When the Press Fails, Political Power and the News Media from Iraq to Katrina. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. You can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering adults an opportunity to think for credit. Details on the web at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stephen Livingston. He is Associate Professor of Media in the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University. He's the co-author of a new book called When the Press Fails, Political Power and the News Media from Iraq to Katrina. If you'd like to join us today, the phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Steve, one thing that seems to have been a major factor after 9/11 was the overwhelming accusation of liberal bias in every corner of mainstream media. And the charge of bias is hard to disprove. It's damaging to a reporter's reputation. How does that affect, though, the way journalists try to inject balance into their stories?
Well, the typical charge of liberal bias is indeed hard to disprove, but it's hard to prove as well. I mean, one of the things that we try to keep in mind in the study is that there are other factors that we need to think about when we try to understand why the news looks as it does. And when we do that, we think the individual biases of a reporter shouldn't be entirely discounted, but they are only one of a number. That's only one of a number of what the factors that influence news output. Among other things, take a look at the concentration of corporate ownership of the news media. Like any of us, if you could imagine, if you have a job as a reporter or as any other sort of function in a corporation, you try to do what's expected of you according to the demands of the corporation. So when you think about the fact that five or so corporations own most of the media in the United States, that's a factor that needs to be taken into consideration, and we think it's a more important one than simply what the ideological orientation may or may not be of an individual reporter.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's talk to Joe in Dallas. Hi, Joe.
Hi. It's a very interesting program. I think I have a contribution. I'm 88 years old, and I go back to the time of when the United Nations established Israel. It was a tremendous effect on what was written by news reporters by the ownership of the paper. And advertisers could bring a great influence on a newspaper as to what stories they will run, and therefore the ownership of the paper could influence the reporter on what he writes about. Wonder maybe you could comment on that.
Well, Joe, first of all, it's an honor to talk with you. I think that really, in a sense, what you've just said is supportive of or in parallel with the last point that I made. When you think about the factors that influence the news media, one of them has to be the economic incentives or pressures that newspapers, radio, NPR perhaps in a slightly different way, but and television are affected by the needs of the bottom line. And when you have, for instance, a Rupert Murdoch in the News Corporation now having offered a bid for even the Wall Street Journal, when you have the New York Times that has, because of its economic structure, has been insulated at least historically from those kinds of economic pressures, but that may be changing as well. These are important factors. The Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, all over the country, we're looking at how newspapers are cutting back on staff, closing down bureaus overseas. That has a tremendous effect on what we do or do not know about the world around us. So I think Joe's point is well taken.
How have the kinds of sources that we turn to for balance really changed over the past few years? There's a lot of sort of he said, she said reporting out there.
Yeah, well, it depends upon the issue, though. What we find in our research, not only in this book but elsewhere, with some kinds of issues, domestic issues in particular, issues having to do with economics or with abortion or whatever, there's a wider array of sources that can be turned to and understood as offering legitimate points of view. But in foreign affairs, particularly after 9/11, it's a much more restricted array of quote-unquote experts or others who could offer a legitimate, well-informed point of view on terrorism, on the wisdom of invading Iraq or not invading Iraq, and more recently on the wisdom of the administration's stance towards Iran. In those kinds of issues, there seems to be fewer people that the New York Times and the Washington Post and other similar kinds of newspapers and news organizations turn to on a regular basis.
Part of the problem, I'm wondering if it doesn't have to do with the fact that no matter what a journalist sets out to do, if, for example, someone is sent to Iraq to cover things, most of the time they're going to be stuck inside the green zone, or they might be embedded with troops, but they are in many ways sort of beholden to U.S. interests.
Absolutely, and that's true. And my goodness, there have been more journalists killed in the line of doing their professional duty and their job in Iraq than anywhere else in the world. And this, again, as I said earlier in our program, our book does not cast aspersions at individual journalists, and there are heroic individual journalists, certainly in Iraq. You know, in a sense, we're very interested, though, in what led up to the situation where we're in a war that is so dangerous that journalists and the Marines and the soldiers are constantly subject to danger. Let's step back and remember what we were told by supporters of the invasion in late 2002 and before March of 2003. One of the administration supporters said it would be a cakewalk, that we'd be greeted with open arms. And the press reported that. The New York Times and the Post and others reported that. What we want to know in the book is, how did we get to where we are now in Iraq, in the situation that you've aptly described, and what we were told back then? What explained the reporting back then?
Well, and it makes a great deal of sense that you focus on the most influential news outlets in this country for your study. And I'm wondering about the problem of sort of bandwagon journalism, because you could have one paper or broadcast outlet that went with a very different perspective on something. But if everyone else is reporting something different, it begins to appear that one lone voice is just incorrect or misguided.
Yeah, and I'm really glad you've asked that question, because one of the things that I really want to emphasize is that we don't talk about the media. We're not focusing on all American news organizations. Not to appear pandering or anything, but there have been studies that found that people who listen to NPR did not have the same level of misunderstanding about key elements. I mean, NPR listeners relative to Fox News viewers did not confuse the idea that Saddam was behind 9/11. A majority, or something approximating majority, of Fox viewers misunderstood that. NPR listeners understood that there wasn't broad support in the international community for the American invasion. Other consumers of news did not understand that. But to go back to your original question, I mean, there are news organizations in this country that are so influential and so important that they do, as you just said, a bandwagoning effect or an agenda-setting function. If the New York Times has a story on its front page, or CNN is leading with a story, you know, on a repetitive basis on their news programming, there's a tendency of other news organizations, just as you said, to not want to appear out of step with conventional wisdom, and so they will follow the same story, the same lead, and maybe even, you know, the same parameters of how the story is framed. And that's an important factor.
Yeah, and the way the business works, too, it's very often people who are at those publications and broadcast outlets have sort of reached the pinnacle of their career. So it would make sense that smaller publications, you know, people are somewhat less experienced and would look almost for guidance to those big papers and broadcast outlets.
Well, not only that. I mean, the talent that's involved with the New York Times or the Post is quite clear at the individual level of journalists. But just in terms of resources, the New York Times just pours millions of dollars a year into its reporting. I read a figure the other day that said that the newsroom in the New York Times spends about $200 million a year. I haven't seen that or verified it, but it's an enormous amount of money. And very few other news organizations can match that. And so you're right. You end up with a guidance function going on between newspapers like The Times and other news organizations around the country.
An email from Pete in Arlington says, many people think that NPR and PBS have been more willing to challenge the administration than the elite newspapers. Would a national public newspaper structured and funded similar to NPR and PBS be a solution?
What an interesting idea. I haven't actually ever heard that considered before. I think that I would prefer to see just simply more money put into NPR and public broadcasting services. I think we have a model in the fine reporting of the BBC, and I think NPR and PBS could simply use more money. So how's that for a plug for NPR? For you?
Thanks for that. Your coffee mug is in the mail. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email us at think@kera.org. My guest is Steve Livingston. He's a co-author of When the Press Fails, Political Power and the News Media from Iraq to Katrina. Let's talk next to Gordon in Dallas. Hi, Gordon.
Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
Great.
This is really interesting. Excuse me. When I was in journalism school, we were told unequivocally, almost on the first day, that complete objectivity was virtually impossible. And, you know, I worked for a really small newspaper several years ago, and I had a lot of latitude in what I could write and what I didn't want to write. And I struggled with that he said, she said type of balance. And one of the solutions that I came up with was putting something in context. I mean, if I went to one source, I would try to frame that source in a certain context, you know, and put the interests down, you know, of that person down, and, you know, what might be driving comments like that and such. But, you know, in big newspapers, and let's say like the Dallas Morning News, for example, the length of the news stories is so short that that sort of thing is impossible. And what I'd like to hear your guest comment upon is why newspapers like the Dallas Morning News feel compelled to give us this really, really abbreviated news when a good newspaper like the New York Times gives us lengthy, comprehensive articles with a lot of context and maybe even some reportorial interpretation involved within the story. You know, why, you know, when newspapers are really struggling for balance and objectivity, it seems to me that, you know, explanations are necessary, not abbreviated news stories, and I'd like to hear something about that.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah. Gordon, that's a very good point. And, of course, when you step outside of the realm of newspapers and you look at television news, network television news, or with regards to international affairs, what content there is devoted to that by your local news is even more abbreviated, and that's the nature of the medium. I mean, television news simply isn't in a position of offering the sort of in-depth analysis that a New York Times or a New Yorker or a New York Review of Books or other similar contextualizing sources of journalism are able to do. And I, frankly, I don't have an opportunity to read the Dallas newspaper on a regular basis, but you can look at national newspapers. USA Today used to sometimes be chided for offering McNugget news or small bite-sized bits of news. One of the standard explanations as to why newspapers do that is that they assume that their readers have short attention spans, that they're not interested in the details of international affairs. I think that that's unfair. I think the American public would benefit and do want to hear more of the details and the context that's involved in complex stories. If that sort of thing had been provided, maybe we would not have been so willing to misunderstand that somehow Saddam was involved with 9/11 rather than Al-Qaeda. If we knew something about the difference between the Ba'athist regime in Iraq and the Wahhabist Al-Qaeda adherents. So, why? I think it's operating assumptions of some newspapers. I applaud his effort as a journalist or former journalist to provide context. That's I think, key.
It is. It does certainly, though, speak to a responsibility of the audience to demonstrate that they really do have, by and large, a great interest.
But, Chris, it's a chicken or egg argument, isn't it? I mean, certainly if you're listeners think back, if you go, for instance, if you go on vacation to some place, you come away from, you know, overseas, you go to Italy, you go to Europe, you go to India, wherever you go, you come back with a sense of knowing something about that place that heightens your subsequent interest in news about it. Well, I think the same can be achieved if you simply educate yourself or are educated by the news that you read that offers context, that offers the, as Gordon identified, offers the sort of background information that provides a framework for you to build on that. So, yes, it's true that readers and listeners need to show an interest to encourage news organizations to offer quality journalism. But at the same time, quality journalism needs to be there in the first place in order to provide the means for the audience to know what it is they need, what they're missing in their daily news diet.
Stephen Livingston is my guest. His new book is called When the Press Fails, Political Power and the News Media from Iraq to Katrina. The phone number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is think@kera.org. Let's go next to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Oh, hello. I was just thinking, you know, I've thought about that chicken and egg question myself, too. I think probably the best way to describe that phenomenon is using evolution. It's natural, or it's selection by concentrating news medias in megamedia corporations, certain things are selected, and that influences, you know, later offspring of that same system. But my question was, I'm glad you brought up megamedia corporations. you know, what I'm really worried about these mega media corporations, and when I try to find information on them on the web, it's almost impossible to find. Frankly, I think they should be broken up, but I understand that it would be hard for either party to get behind that issue. But couldn't we at least make a law that would force every media business, you know, whether it's newspaper, magazine, or a TV show or channel, to post on the web the hierarchy of who owns them, you know, up the chain to the top? And at least then we would know who owns these companies and what their interests are.
Mm-hmm. Steve, do you think that would make a difference?
Well, I think it would make a difference if we knew who owned what. And just to help John and the other listeners, you can find that information. I mean, if you were just to go to the Internet and Google, for instance, somebody named Ben Bagdikian, or a book called The Media Monopoly, or just simply ask for that book on Amazon, you would find other related books and other resources that you'd find really quite quickly. But, I mean, it is a concern. If you look at, just randomly choose, who owns NBC? Well, ultimately, who owns NBC News is General Electric. General Electric is a major defense contractor. So some of the critics ask questions such as, well, how does that affect NBC's news coverage of the Defense Department? Now, frankly, I don't think you can see any smoking guns and memos from General Electric saying don't cover defense contracting in a particular way, but you do have to wonder how implicitly that might influence NBC's coverage.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because there is never, you know, I've worked in newsrooms as well, and there's never someone who walks up to your desk and says, you'll do this story, or in most places, you would hope.
But you've never worked for Fox News.
Yeah, no, I never have. But there is a certain, you know, you have to wonder about how small decisions ultimately impact the overall product.
Sure, and political climates. I mean, I wasn't being entirely facetious when I said you've never worked for Fox News, because one of the things that we know is that the Fox News channel says it's fair and balanced. Well, from a particular perspective, it may be. But Roger Ailes is the founder of that. Roger Ailes worked for the Reagan administration. He in turn, works for Rupert Murdoch. And so there is a political climate that comes about in that sort of environment that encourages coverage of particular type.
Our conversation with Steve Livingston continues after the break. The telephone number, if you'd like to join us, is 1-800-933-5372, and our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering adults an opportunity to think for credit. Details on the web at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this afternoon is Associate Professor in the School of Media and Public Affairs and the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University, Stephen Livingston. He's co-author of the book When the Press Fails, Political Power and the News Media from Iraq to Katrina. I don't want to ignore Katrina, Steve, because you found in your evaluations of content a real turnaround at that point in the way the media in this country were interacting with the administration.
Yeah, it's important that we not let what happened in Katrina slip by us here. What we find in our, I should actually even back up further and explain that the conclusions that we reach in the book are a result of a systematic series of content analyses where you take news reports and you analyze them using various instruments, coding instruments, that produce not an impressionistic reading of what the news said or did not say, but rather, with the assistance of a lot of graduate students and all of us, all three authors, we spent a lot of time looking at the news content. And what we found with Katrina is that there were episodes where the media actually saw and reported for themselves. They offered the kind of context, I guess, that Gordon, one of our listeners, talked about earlier, where they said, look, the government, FEMA, isn't stepping forward in offering the kind of solutions that are needed by the people caught in this horrible condition. And so we walk away from our analysis of Katrina saying this is an example of what the press could be like in the United States, relatively free from spin of government officials that are self-serving and really standing up to the claims that are made by these same officials in saying, yes, we are doing X, Y, and Z, when actually they weren't.
You know what's so frustrating, though, about that comparison, Steve, is that with Katrina, it was relatively easy for journalists to get physically into the heart of what was going on. They didn't have to rely upon officials because they could speak to the human beings who were affected. It's more difficult to do that in a war zone half a world away. So what do we do to sort of bring the good of Katrina into other kinds of reporting?
Yeah. Well, you know, elsewhere in the book we talk about how information technology has allowed journalists to do around the world what they were able to do in Katrina. We don't think there's a substantial difference in the technological capability of how one could report from a disaster zone in the Mississippi Delta and the way in which one could report from a war zone in Iraq. Now, granted, getting out of the green zone these days is next to impossible, but that doesn't mean that the only source of critical reporting that you can bring to bear on reporting Iraq comes from the Defense Department or the White House. It could come from elsewhere, and it could come from the academic community. It could come from the NGOs. It could come from other foreign sources. It could come from the Iraqis themselves to a much greater degree. The second thing, though, that I would like to do is just remind all of us that we're talking about reporting before it became too dangerous to leave the green zone. We're trying to understand why it ended up becoming a circumstance of where we're sort of blindsided by the fact that we find ourselves in the midst of a civil war. Why didn't we know that going into the war in 2003? So the book and our analysis tries to understand why we find ourselves in this situation now. Why didn't we have better insight into it in 2003 when reporters were able to move more freely around Iraq?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's talk next to Robbie in Plano. Hi, Robbie.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I have a comment and then a question. I think the place where really the press fails us is the lack of international coverage that I see on almost any channel. The local news are just, I guess, they're very too local that most of the people watch. And perhaps the business model that we follow over here is not conducive to the kind of press responsibilities that ultimately they should carry out. I mean, everything is looked at from profit and loss. And so ultimately, I think it doesn't lead itself to a good, balanced coverage of the world. My question is that recently World Media Watch ranked U.S. 53rd, I believe, on like a list of 150 nations in terms of freedom of press. And I find this very surprising. Does your guest know anything about this? Is this really, is there not a freedom of press as much as we think it is there? Could you perhaps comment on this?
You know, I don't know enough about it to feel comfortable commenting right now with any sort of confidence, but you could well imagine that among other factors, such a study would look at these episodes where the various courts have actually jailed American journalists or people who claim to the status of journalism. We recently had an episode of where a young independent videographer, a journalist, if you will, in San Francisco spent a good number of weeks, months in jail because he refused to cooperate with an investigation into a protest that was held there in San Francisco some time ago. You've had other examples of where journalists who have refused to hand over information regarding their sources, including Judith Miller, who've spent time in jail. So those are the kinds of factors that I think would lead to the conclusion that the United States does not have the sort of freedom of the press that we sometimes think that it does. You know, your other point is really interesting. The lack of international coverage, I think, is one of the problems that we really need to find a solution to in this country. If you remember, remember back after 9/11, the network said that they realized, the television network said that they realized that they had failed the American public, their viewers, because of the lack of coverage. They had been shutting down bureaus all over the world in this effort at cutting back at costs because of the economic model that's been applied, as Robbie said. And we end up with an impoverished news diet having to do with the world. So we end up asking questions like, why do they hate us? Why don't they understand us more? We also end up with the circumstance of not being able to tell the difference between the 9/11 bombers and Saddam Hussein. So we pay a heavy cost for the lack of international content in our coverage.
Clearly, journalists everywhere read the work of other journalists and consume the work of other journalists. I'm wondering, though, if you were able to get a sense for how many Americans actually consume journalism from reported from other countries. In other words, not the American bureau in, you know, Fallujah, but something that's taking place that is written for an audience that's not American.
Well, in part, here I go again with a plug for NPR, but so many NPR stations around the country are in partnership one way or the other with the BBC. So one of the ways in which the American public is getting a richer diet of international news is through the associations that we have either through PBS and NPR with the BBC, or just simply turning into BBC America or ITN. Sometimes the other British network has programming available here. And so that's one way. Secondly, certainly in the Southwest, in around Dallas, Texas, and everywhere else, the Hispanic Latino population is tied into an alternative journalism. Whether it's better or not, at least it's an alternative journalism out of Latin America. So you find with the growing number of people from other parts of the world, they are turning to their own indigenous media, either via the internet or global television of one sort or another.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Mike in Dallas. Hi, Mike.
Hi. The topic I'd like to have your guest discuss a little bit is how we are influenced or how spin is applied by kind of style, like tone of voice and speed of talking and things like that. And, of course, you know, you immediately think of Fox News and MSNBC and so on, but the most disheartening example of it that I've experienced was on NPR when build up to the Iraq War, and I would listen in the morning to Morning Edition when I'd get in the car, and I would hear not only content that was discouraging, but actually the style in which it was presented. It was as if this is really true, and it's and Saddam is really a threat. And those of us who listen to NPR a lot probably follow the news and knew that there was no connection between Osama and Saddam, and we knew this was we were being misled, and it was so sad to hear NPR doing that. And but it was very effective, maybe. You know, that's what I'd like to hear him talk about. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
You know, broadcasting, whether it's on radio or television, one of the things that lends credibility or legitimacy is an authoritative voice. If you can speak in declarative sentences that sound as if what you're saying has been the subject of great review, and in many instances, of course, it is. I myself can't comment one way or the other about NPR's coverage. I didn't study it in depth, didn't listen to it except as a casual listener. But we can simply say that as a matter of style, broadcasting has to do with a certain declarative voice. A wonderful, entertaining example of that is seen in a relatively recent movie where Edward R. Murrow is depicted, I think, brilliantly by the actor in a movie called Good Night and Good Luck. That sort of very authoritative, this is the way the world is. Walter Cronkite, sign off, and that's the way the world is, and giving the date. We look for that as a legitimating element to our news reporting, and it simply goes with the territory, I think, of broadcasting.
800-933-5372 is our phone number. Let's go next to Stephen in Denton. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. My question was about spin and how people might be able to cut through the spin. Like, since it's coming from, like, say, with the Iraq War, since it's coming from the government and there's no real way for some reporters to get into what the government is seeing and the intelligence and that kind of thing, is there a way before the Iraqi War happened for the media to actually find out if what they're reporting to us is true and kind of get their own intelligence, similar with what they did in Katrina. And also I was wondering about, you had said that it was hard for television stations to report in depth on really complicated stories, but with 24-hour stations on TV, would it be more logical for them to cover the more in-depth stories instead of just going blurb after blurb after blurb and repeating those all throughout the day?
Yeah, those are good questions, Stephen. Let me take the second one first. One of the things that we need to, at least in my view, keep in mind about CNN and MSNBC and Fox News Channel in particular is that they're on 24 hours a day, but they're not 24-hour news channels. I think you implied the answer yourself just now. They do about 20 minutes of news that's repeated 24 hours a day. Content costs. And in any news organization that's trying to cut back on the costs of producing content, they find ways of repackaging the same content and airing it for an extended period of time. Certainly CNN has, in recent years, last couple of years, devoted more time and energy to producing documentaries. Here in the School of Media and Public Affairs at GW, one of my faculty colleagues is Frank Sesno, who's a special correspondent for CNN, as well as being a professor here at GW. And I know that Frank is involved in producing documentaries for CNN. So different 24-hour news organizations actually do a better job one way or the other at that. In terms of cutting through the spin, two answers to that. Number one, I think, as was said earlier, part of the responsibility must rest with all of us. I mean, there are places where we can do the reading. You can turn to books. You can turn to news magazines that do spend more time looking at the context and the background and the history of events, and we can prepare ourselves in that way to see through the reporting and put it in our own context that I think would prove helpful.
What sort of response have you had, Steve, from journalists who have read this book? Is there an acknowledgement that mistakes have been made and that we need to change things, or does everybody read it and say, yeah, those guys really messed up?
Well, first of all, except for a few exceptions, I mean, Frank Rich, who's a columnist for the New York Times, I know Frank has read the book and has had nice things to say about it. The book is out just a month or so now, so I'm not sure it's in the hands of a lot of journalists. But so far, the response that we've gotten is that, yeah, you know, what you've done is you've identified some important issues that's faced by some parts of the American news media, and we need to do some things to rectify these issues, these problems.
Are you confident that any subsequent administrations, Republican, Democratic, or otherwise, won't try and hang on to some of the additional control that the Bush administration has put in place?
Oh, certainly. I think they will. I mean, whether it's Democrat or Republican, this is a bipartisan issue here. The question really is, what will the news media do to reclaim its historical stake and role as a source of accountability in American politics? So it's up to the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, even under the ownership possibly of Rupert Murdoch, to say, what are we going to do differently so as to make sure that we don't make these same mistakes again? And so as we go into Iran, confrontations with Iran, are we about to make the same mistakes there as we did going into Iraq?
Stephen Livingston's new book is called When the Press Fails, Political Power and the News Media from Iraq to Katrina. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro, with production assistance from Maggie Conklin. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.